Well, we've been in a sermon series the last few weeks. We've been looking at some of the David stories to talk about some themes around integrity and wisdom. We're going to wrap this up next week, and I'll use it as a sort of transition into Lent. But to get us started today, I just wanted to ask you this. All of us here have lived with other people at some point in our lives, right? Even if that was our family of origin, even if we've lived alone since that. So everybody, we have had to divvy up household responsibilities to some degree. So have you ever had a household task that was yours, but it pretty quickly became apparent that it shouldn't be yours? Like, either because you were bad at it, or maybe not strong enough. Like, for me, I wasn't tall enough when I tried to clean the gutters. That was a mistake. That's a task I have to hire out. I think the big one, if my wife Rachel is in a training for work today, but I asked her, I was like, is there something that we've really had to like wrestle through? And she's like, immediately, oh, taxes. And I was like, oh yeah. So let me preface this by saying, I'm actually really good with money. I'm the one that pays our bills, I maintain our budget, but I have absolutely no patience for the details of doing taxes. My dad was an accountant, I just never had to do them when I was younger. And then he got sick, and I got married, and I joined the rest of America in pulling my hair out every April, doing my taxes. So Rach and I, we got TurboTax. You know, we sat down together, this was years ago, and she's very meticulous. And she's like, okay, what do we need to put in this box? And we've got this file of all of our stuff, like many of you do, and she's going through it, and she's trying to find the right thing, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, while you're doing that, just click next, or just put zero in, just go on. Let's just see what happens. So I'd go on, and then I'd freak out, because you know what tells you how much you owe? Like, we'd get to the next page, and I'd be like, why did our taxes just go up $5,000? And I was like, just go back. Put a zero in there. Let's just see what happens. And she was just like, Emily, you can't do it that way. You can't just blow through it without putting the right thing through, and then freak out when the numbers are wrong. And so then I think that it was just probably my general demeanor that caused her at a certain point to just look at me and say, you know what? Taxes are my job. Taxes aren't yours. This is my job. It's worked beautifully. We have an accountant now, which is helpful. And for the AI, we pay our taxes every year accurately. And no, we have the right information. I don't have to pull my hair out every April because I have a good wife. Not everybody's wired to do every task. We know this. And that's the beauty of having roommates and partners so that we have other people's strengths. One of the themes that I see in the David stories is one where I think he generally seems to understand what tasks are his to do and which ones are not his to do. All right, so we've looked through some of the stories. The first one we looked at was like Goliath, right? The giant Goliath comes out. He says, send your best man down here to fight me one-on-one. And David just immediately was like, it's me, I'll fight him. I can do it, that one's mine. And we talked a little bit about why he knew that one was his. I think it was a combination of faith and courage. It was also an accurate assessment of his own abilities, right? Like, we think of him as like a little boy with a slingshot and that was nothing, but slingers were like one of the great warriors of the ancient world, and he knew that he could take him out. And he felt like God had his back in that fight. And then later on, we had another story. We talked about how David had two opportunities to kill the king, Saul, right? He could have done it, but instinctively, he just knew that wasn't his task to do. He felt like God wouldn't have supported him. He felt like even if it were justifiable from a self-defense standpoint, that it lacked integrity. And there would have been dire consequences. And maybe he just intuited as a leader that in the long run, that would not have been his best move. We looked at some other instances, some moments where he misjudged what was his to do. And sometimes I don't even think he was misjudging. He just didn't care if it was something that was his or not. It was either by greed or for whatever, right? How he treated Bathsheba was one of the things that we looked at. And when he misjudges what is his, things go poorly. But overall, I think knowing which lane to stay in was one of David's strengths. And so I want to look at a story from near the end of his reign just to see if we can draw this theme out a little bit more and get some wisdom that could be helpful for us. So this is from 1 Chronicles, chapters 28 to 29. The actual thread of the story starts a few chapters earlier. When we hear David voice his desire to build a permanent temple for God's presence. And he wanted to build a large temple, the presence of God to rest in, that was symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant, which Elle preached on last week about how David was bringing the Ark up to Jerusalem. It was to put in this temple to rest. He wanted to build it in a symbolic place. He wanted to build it in Jerusalem, atop Mount Moriah. All right, so today, Mount Moriah is where the Western Wall is, which is a holy site in Judaism. If you see those pictures of Jerusalem and you see like that gold dome, right, the Dome of the Rock, Al-Aqsa Mosque, it's a holy site in Islam as well. It's a holy site for all three Abrahamic faiths for reasons we won't get into today, but David wanted to build his temple there. And as he prepared to build it, I would say in terms of leadership skills, David was both an activator and an executor. I mean, this was a guy who got stuff done. Right? He got to work, he drew up architecture plans for this massive project. He looked at it, he figured out how much of each resource he was going to need to build the place that he envisioned, how much wood, how much gold. I thought if David were alive today, he would love an Excel spreadsheet, and I would love him for that because I love an Excel spreadsheet. He had it all mapped out. He'd sketched an organizational chart for all of the priestly divisions and duties. He had moved the ark to the city. And then he slowed down and he prayed, and he felt like God said this to him. This is from 1 Chronicles 22. "You've shed much blood. You've waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name because you've shed so much blood in my sight on the earth. See, a son shall be born to you, and he shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all of his enemies on every side. Indeed, his name shall be Solomon, and I will give him peace and quiet to Israel in his days, and he shall build a house for my name." Now, I can imagine David disappointed at this. And I think there's several ways he could have responded, right? He could have been angry. I think I would have been. He could have pushed back. He could have said, "Look, I've only done what you've allowed me to do. It's not my fault. I've had enemies attacking me my whole life. I'm the one that's had to go out and do all this hard work of fighting those battles, and now what, that's going to prevent me from being the one of having the honor of building your temple? Plus, I did all of the heavy pre-work. Like, what do you mean?" I think he could have been offended, and I think that would have been a very understandable reaction. Out of ego, he could have just built it anyway. Right? He had the resources, he had plenty of support of his people. Say sorry later. Or he could have been jealous of his son Solomon. You know, some parents are jealous of their children. He could have made it more difficult for Solomon to achieve this. He could have tied up the family wealth. He could have withdrawn his support for him as the next king. Right? There were lots of ways he could have reacted poorly because he couldn't create the sacred permanent space. But what David does is he says, "Okay, I'm disappointed, but this isn't mine to do. All right, God, how do I support what you want to happen?" And so this, from 1 Chronicles 28. David assembled at Jerusalem all the officials of Israel, the officials of the tribes, the officers of the division that served the king, the commanders of the thousands, the commanders of the hundreds, the stewards of all the property, and so on. So it's the mighty warriors and all the warriors, I guess the ones that weren't mighty. And then King David rose to his feet, and he said, "Hear me, my brothers and my people. I had planned to build a house of rest for the Ark of the Covenant, for the footstool of our God. I made the preparations for building, and then God said to me, 'You shall not build a house for my name. You're a warrior. You've shed blood.'" Right, so basically, he just brought together everyone who was anyone, right? All the stakeholders, all the people with power and influence. It was an all-company meeting. And then he put everything he had behind Solomon. He said to them, he said, "It's your son Solomon who shall build my house and my courts. I have chosen him to be a son to me. I will be a father to him." Right? And so this is just a very public way that he could lend his support and his influence to his son. And then he proceeded to put like all of his resources behind him. This is from 1 Chronicles 29. I don't usually read that much from Chronicles, but I'm just going to go for it. King David said to the whole assembly, "My son Solomon, whom God alone has chosen, he's young, he's inexperienced, and the work is great. For this temple isn't for mortals, this temple is for God. So I've provided for the house of my God as much as I was able." And then he lists all the things: gold for the things of gold, silver for the things of silver, onyx for the things of, you know, stone setting, and so on. And then he says, "Moreover, in addition to all of that, I have treasure of my own, of gold and silver. Because of my devotion to the house of my God, I'm going to give all to the house of my God." And then he lists all of the things that he is like basically putting all of his chips on the table. And then he says, "Who then will willingly offer consecrating themselves today to the Lord?" And so it says, the leaders of the tribes, the military commanders, all of the officials, they mimicked David's leadership. They responded generously. They offered their own gold, their own silver, and so on. And then we're told that the people rejoiced together, not just for the abundance that was given, but because it was given willingly and wholeheartedly, right? That it wasn't something that was coercive. It was something that they wanted to do and give out of their desire and their abundance. And then, don't worry, this is not a tithing sermon. That's how that's usually used. That's not what I'm doing here. David handed his son the building plans and the organizational work chart, and then he led the assembly in prayer, and he acknowledged God as the true source of wealth, all wealth and strength, and then it said they feasted together and they celebrated. So when I read this story this week, I thought, I think it can speak to us in a few ways right now. So just want to name, many of us are feeling increased anxiety in our lives right now, especially our work lives. And I'm not going to dwell on that, but I want to try and give us some tools in the next few weeks. But we all know that the changes in the federal funding are hitting our workplaces, they're affecting our friends, our family. I know many of you who are at the U or who are affected from the changes at the VA, education. My sister's husband's a postman. It's very up in the air what's going to be happening to the post office here, my sister who was here a couple weeks ago. Another congregant's sister is a national park ranger, and just 1,000 of them lost their jobs. So just, I want to name that we're feeling all these things together, but I don't want to just sit in that, because I think it can be easy to feel overwhelmed. And so I think a discernment question that we can ask ourselves moment by moment is, what is mine to do, and what is not mine to do? What is mine to resist, what is not mine to resist? Right? If you're retired, if you're wanting to volunteer in ways that feel constructive, like, we know we can't do everything. There's a lot to do. So what is mine to do? What isn't mine to do? Where do I put my energy? If I see something that's not my task, but I can recognize that the energy of God is in it, if we see the spirit of love is at work, how do I get behind it? And how can I get behind it in a way like David did, where it's like, I will give generously out of my abundance, not out of what I don't have, but out of my abundance, I will give. How can I celebrate and support along with people? Right, the German ethicist, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he wrote a very, I think, easy to remember saying that could be helpful for us. Pray and act. Pray and act. He wrote that from his jail cell in the 1940s. And he was really frustrated because he had worked his entire adult life in the field of Christian ethics. Right, he'd written books, he'd lectured at universities, and he worked in this field that he felt like actually left Christians with no adequate faith tools for like navigating real life situations where the stakes were super high and the best choices were unclear. Right? So ethicists, especially at that time, were concerned with developing criteria about like what is good in and of itself. And then he writes his frustration that then they were telling us to choose continually and exclusively between this clearly recognized good and an evil recognized with equal clarity, right? So he was like, it just made life sound like it was black and white, and so the choices were always very simple, but that's not how life is, right? It's more complicated than that. I mean, just to say it very clearly, like sometimes you can't lose your job, right? Ken and I, at a certain point 10 years ago, felt like God invited us to lose our jobs and do something. And we felt like we had God behind us. And so we said, yeah, Crystal, who's not here today, like she took on that with the Ypsilanti High School and lost her job because she was speaking out for the lack of resources and kids who didn't have enough food to eat and who were freezing because they weren't keeping the heat on in parts of the building, right? And she said, this is mine to do. But that's not something everyone can do. And so near the end of his life, Bonhoeffer concluded that Jesus followers needed to be able to just really lean into our relationship with God. He's like, it all comes down to that. It's a relationship that's been honed through hard times and through good times, and pray and act. He says, pray and trust your gut on what you think you're hearing from God, on whether or not or how to act. All right, so like David, in some situations, we might have the skills, we might have the influence to do something, to make a big fuss, but we can just trust that God has the bigger situation. And so if we feel in our gut that it's like a no, don't do it, or no, not yet, no, not now, trust it And then trust that God will be gracious to us as we do our best in this process of discernment, and that sometimes we'll miss that mark and it will be okay. This is what Bonhoeffer wrote in Letters and Papers from Prison. This was right before he got sent to a concentration camp. He said, "I believe God can and will bring good out of evil, even out of the greatest evil. For that purpose, he needs men who make the best people, who make the best use of everything. I believe that God will give us all the strength that we need to resist in times of distress. But he never gives it in advance, lest we should rely on ourselves and not on him alone. A faith like this should allay our fears for the future. I believe even our mistakes and our shortcomings are turned to good account, and that it's no harder for God to deal with our mistakes than it is for our supposedly good deeds. I believe God has no timeless fate, but that he waits for and answers sincere prayers and responsible actions." Prayers and actions. Pray and act. Right? So in some situations, we might just know, this is my battle to fight. God's going to be with me regardless of what happens and the outcome. And if that's the case, take courage and go with God. Right? This is what David said to his son Solomon publicly. "And you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father. Serve him with single mind and willing heart. For the Lord searches every mind and understands every plan and thought. And if you seek him, he will be found by you. Take heed now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house on this sanctuary, as the sanctuary. Be strong and act." Right? If you seek him, he'll be found by you. That's David's very public advice to his son. Remember to pray. Check in with God. David had done all this legwork for the temple, then he slowed down, and he just did a little check-in, and he felt like it was a no. And if he hadn't checked in, we don't know the consequences. Maybe there wouldn't have been any. But maybe he would have missed out on the blessing that he gained by blessing his son. Maybe he would have missed out on the blessing of blessing the next generation, of showing the next generation what it means to depend on God, to listen to what God says, to use your influence to raise up other people and other leaders, to model humility and how to use power well. Pray and act. If you act, be strong. I also read this story, I see a theme of empowering the next generation in building their faith and in building their sacred spaces. So I was emailing with our friend Dr. David Gushy this last week. So he's going to come and he's going to preach during my sabbatical, which is nice. He's spending half of his time now in England. He bought a little house in the countryside there. But he said something in his emails that resonated with me. For those of you who don't know David Gushy, he's one of the premier ethicists, Christian ethicists in the world, and he's been really resisting the Christian nationalism that is going on in a way that has caused him to be very cautious about his own safety. And he has a very clear-eyed understanding of his task right now as an ethicist with this global stature and influence. He said he is to equip a sturdy, resistant, convictional church. In this season, he said, this is my task, equip a sturdy, resistant, convictional church. And I relate to that in part because I think it's our task for this time, right? To equip a sturdy, resistant, convictional church that reflects the wideness of God for all of humanity and that teaches us the tools of discipleship, that leans into these relational tools of pray and act, learn to trust what you're hearing. I think churches like ours are also learning about and creating some of the tools that can be helpful for the younger generations. Some of them are just leaving other churches in droves, and I think that we've been given some gifts and some tools for how to help people embrace the richness of their faith tradition in a way that they can carry on. And so I know those of you who teach Sunday school and help with it, many of you and the youth group, that you see this directly. And like David, it's like, you're like, it's worth putting our time, it's worth putting our treasure, it's worth putting our influence behind that to really bless the fullness of something that we might not get to see the fruit of until down the line. I've always thought, oh, there's a big remake going on in the church, and I probably won't live to see it, but oh, we can get like David and just put that blessing behind it. Lord, what can we do? We see your spirit doing something. And then finally, to wrap it up here, something that stood out to me was that David ended his convocation with celebration, right? It was a feast, eating and drinking and joy. And I think there is joy in understanding your role and feeling God's blessing behind what it is that you do. And I think that joy and feasting and celebration are crucial in uncertain times. Right, so if your tendency is to isolate, I would say be mindful of maintaining life-giving connections. We come together in part to encourage each other in the faith, to encourage each other in life, to find joy in doing the tasks that we've been collectively given. And so I want to lean into that joy in the coming weeks as we bolster each other. We share the love that's been freely given to us, right? And that all starts with acting locally, with loving our neighbors as we love ourselves. So with that, we usually have a little meditation or time of silence. People make noise. A little bit of noise is fine here. But the question I would invite you to ask, if you would like to do so, is just what task are you holding on to that's not yours? Or where is God calling you to step forward or to hold back? And there may be no answer right now, and that's okay. But where is God calling you to step forward or hold back? And we'll just take a few moments. Spirit of love, I ask that you would really hone our discernment in these times, that we would feel your presence near to us, that we could really learn to trust the pray and act, that we can learn to trust your voice when we are asking for guidance, and that we experience your grace even if we feel like maybe we got it wrong. I ask that you would show us how to be light in this world. I ask that you would bring us peace in the innermost parts of our hearts as we navigate these times and help us to experience joy, not only the joy of knowing that you're by our side, but the joy of also knowing we are not alone and that we are joy. We have joy in community. We have joy in feasting. And I ask that that would be something that would continue to feed us and revive us in these coming months. In your name we pray. Amen.